The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
L'Asteroid Bros presenta il Fantaquiz del giovedì. Il Fantaquiz. Tutti i giovedì alle 12. Vincono ricchi premi. Il Fantaquiz, non mancare.
Allora, una domanda subito per capire come fare questo panel. Se lo facciamo direttamente in inglese, c'è qualcuno che si lamenta? We can do it in English, right? Ok? Va bene? C'è qualcuno che non vuole il panel in inglese?
Volendo si può tradurre, vedrete voi.
C'è Chiara che è disponibile.
Si può fare apertamente, nel senso che se qualcosa ci
va
si
bene.
Ferma e si
va bene, ok, facciamo una cosa interattiva. Ok, so we'll do it in English then. First of all, thank you very much for being here, but it's really an honor and a real pleasure to have you in Milan. Is it the first time in Milan?
Yes.
All right. Good.
It's on now.
All right. I would like to.
Yes, this is my first time in Milan. I've been to Rome, I've been to Venice, and I've been to Rimini, but this is my first time in Milan.
Okay. And you're getting to know Italy.
I'm getting to know Italy. My mother's father was from Naples.
And their name was
Saponaro.
Yeah, Saponaro.
And I'm embarrassed to say that I don't speak good enough Italian to talk to you. But when I get home, I'm going to be able to say, ho passato il weekend a Milano e wow, il tempo era fantastico. But I won't be able to say that till I'm home.
Okay. So let me just say how much Pat Cadigan is important personally for me. I started to read science fiction in Amsterdam, and there was an American guy. He brought his books under the canal on a cellar, and he had a lot of science fiction books. And I spent my university years reading a lot of science fiction, and that's how I get into science fiction. So you can see how these books are used and really
like
full
that.
Of notes of Pat Cadigan and of course Bruce Sterling as well here. So it's really I first met Pat when we were in Lancôme. I met you in Lancôme, and I still can't believe that you're here and that we can talk about the importance of the cyberpunk and the importance of your role in the cyberpunk. Pat has been a very important figure in science fiction and in cyberpunk movement from the early 90s. She has written 5 novels, three of which have been translated in Italian by Shake, and 2 of which have not been translated yet. So one of them is here, is Tea from an Empty Cup, and the other one is Dervish is Digital. So I hope that soon some of her novels will be translated as well. And the first novels, I'm thinking about Mind Players, I'm thinking about Sinners and Fools, really expand in a way the idea of the cyberpunk, involving music, involving the effect of hyperconsumism, the effect of technology on our mind and body. So I've prepared some questions. Let me start with this. From the virtual reality in Sinners and Fools to the artificial reality in Tea from an Empty Cup and Dervish is Digital, the cyberpunk tropes of mind uploads and downloads, of the technological penetration of our mind and bodies, up to the economic hyper-privatization of everything, are still your preferred themes? Or maybe, just like you said in an interview, to err is human, but it takes a human with a computer to really fold things up. That's what you said.
It wasn't original, but, you know, it's true. Actually, I've gone into space for my next novel, and it's based... it takes off from the story that I won the Hugo for, the girl thing who went out for sushi, and there's not a lot of the classic stuff that I wrote about, you know, in my first 5 novels, but it's because it's different, you know, I'm different, the world's different, the culture's different, you know, it's like cyberpunk happened and then cyberpunk became. And it's impossible to write a novel like Sinners now. In fact, when people buy Sinners, I tell them there's not as much science fiction in it as there used to be. And I just happened to guess right. But I told this to someone, and she thought, did they suppress it? And I said, no, it just caught up with me. And there are... there are a number of things that are still in the making. Elon Musk announced that he's going to you know, put in sockets in people's heads and interface with the brain. I think that he should read Sinners, figure out where to put the sockets, and then send me some frickin' royalties. Because the man can afford it.
But I think that Strange Days was from 1995, from Catherine Bigelow. I think that owes a lot also.
To yeah, they owe me for that. Actually, they're... I was watching it and listening to my dialogue, but, you know, it, in order to do something about it, I mm-hmm. would have to, like, not need to be able to do something about it, you know. You know.
But no story I've ever turned into a movie or...
One story of mine was turned into a TV movie. The name of the movie is The Cyber Stalking. And it is cheese on toast. You know, it's very cheesy, and doesn't bear much resemblance to the story that was optioned, which is a story called Pretty Boy Crossover. But they gave me a decent credit at the beginning of the movie, based on Pretty Boy Crossover by Pat Cadigan, with nobody else on the screen with me. You know.
Wow.
And they paid rather nicely, not a fortune, but nicely, for the privilege of taking the story and doing something entirely different with it. So, you know, it's like, more power to them. Anyone else who wants to, you know, option my stories and do something completely different with them, you know, it's like, you don't even have to give me credit, just give me the money, you know, and I'm good to go.
Yep. Okay. Well, I've translated that story. It's very good. It's excellent.
That story is, you know, that I was kind of surprised at how much, at how many people like that story. And someone told me that I had captured exactly what it was to be a 16-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Yay. And nobody accused me of appropriating. So.
That's good. All right. Also, we're going into something a little bit more political, right?
Okay.
So, while the US and the UK, as nations, are reacting to the issues of multiculturality, raising walls, closing gates, stuff like that, science fiction during the last years, and the Worldcon in Helsinki was an example of this, with so many panels on translation and the importance of translation, and inclusivity of minority groups. So science fiction that has opened up to the world. Do you feel that science fiction has a role to play in the awareness of the readers?
Actually, I think all popular culture and, you know, high art has a role to play in this sort of thing, because if you are reflecting the world that you live in, you should know that there are many different kinds of people who live in that world. Actually, to answer that question, I have to go back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
My mother grew up in Brooklyn, and her father was from Naples, and he married a nice Jewish girl from Warsaw. And so we were automatically multicultural.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was growing up, I thought everybody celebrated Easter with a ham, matzah, gefilte fish, and leaving one of the chairs at the table empty for Elijah. It made sense to me. And I found out later, people don't eat matzah on the holidays. It surprised me, you know. It's like, why wouldn't they eat matzah? Matzah's good, it's tasty. But, you know, it was not a common thing. And gefilte fish. I would go to other people's houses and they wouldn't have gefilte fish, and I'd ask them about it and they wouldn't even know what I was talking about. So, but my mother said that you need to get along with everybody, you know, all kinds of people. And actually, it will be better if you learn to accept people and even like them. But the basic thing is that you don't have to like them. You don't have to invite them over to your house. You simply have to show them basic good manners. I remember we were going into this store one day, and a black woman and two children were walking ahead of us, and a man was holding this door open, and he said, I didn't hear what he said, but my mother heard it, and she took him by the throat, you know, and she pushed him up against the glass, and she said, you will not do that in front of children. You will show, you know, you will show better breeding than that. And I was just, you know, I thought, oh God, now my mother's found another way to grab me, because I had these braids. She's grabbed me by the braids. I thought, oh no, now she's going to grab me by the throat. But I wasn't ever racist, so she didn't grab me by the throat. But and then we lived in a very poor area. We lived below the poverty line. I lived in a tenement building, and first it was a very heavily Italian neighborhood. In fact, we actually were a mob neighborhood. And I could tell because the neighborhood tavern was called Mafios. You know, but then it got bombed, and most of the Italian families moved out, and things went a bit downhill, and we had an influx of people from the Caribbean, particularly Puerto Ricans. And I loved Puerto Rican kids because they spoke Spanish and English. And they taught us Spanish, and they had this great music, and you know, it's like we were all always playing together in my neighborhood, and I took some stick about it, you know, from kids at school. And I remember one day, I came home to the town building where I lived, and there was some I went to Catholic school for 12 years, wore uniforms, and a nice Jewish girl like me, who knew. I saw some kids, you know, some girls that I went to school with, and they said, "We didn't know you did social work in this building." And I said, "I don't do social work in this building." And they said, "Well, why are you here?" I said, "I live in this building." So I had a different viewpoint from you know, it's like your middle class American. And I remember when I moved from Massachusetts to the Kansas City area, the University of Kansas, which is a little farther out from the Kansas City area, and the racism was so much more pronounced than it was on the East Coast. And I thought to myself, you know, if, because I would see how the students at the University of Kansas were treated, you know, and when I went to Kansas City, I would see how black people were treated in Kansas City. And I thought, man, if they tried this back in Massachusetts, people would be dead. Yeah. And so I grew up with the idea that that the more multicultural you are, the stronger you are. The more you include, the better you are. And this is nature's way, you know, it's like, nature does not say everybody from the same family, whether it's plants or animals or people. Everybody mate, just in the, because, you know, it's like you mule out pretty fast. The bad things come up in the genetics. But if you have a varied gene pool for anything, it becomes so much stronger. There are more combinations and you discover new things. And when I got the science fiction, it had the reputation when I was younger, much younger, of being, you know, old white guy stuff, old American white guy stuff. But the truth is, many science fiction writers slipped things into their stories that got past their racist, sexist editors. And if you know how to read certain of the old stories from the 40s and 50s, you will discover that there are lots of black people in them, and there are lots of women doing different kinds of things in them. You have to read carefully, and you have to know American culture to pick up on it. There's a particular story that I'm thinking of called The Watchers on the Blade by Richard Wilson. And it's a story about people who have been marooned on a planet by space pirates who then go off in the spaceship. And the main character is thinking about bad things that happened to his family, including an uncle who was a professor of mathematics who got framed for a crime that he didn't commit and now is working on a chain gang in the South. This would only happen to a black person. The protagonist of the story, who tells the story, is black. And people will go all the way through the story not knowing that. But what was the question? Oh yeah, multiculturalism. Multiculturalism. And then
racconto che ha citato?
The short story is called The Watchers in the Glade, and it's very by Richard Wilson. Well, I found it in a falling apart issue of the Best of Galaxy. It's not a very well known story, but I read it when I was much younger, and it blew my mind, and not just because of the protagonist, but it's a very unusual story for the time in which it was written. The ending was knocked me out. Anyway, many writers from the Golden Age were Jewish, and they knew what it was like to be persecuted and marginalized. So they didn't want to exclude. They thought in terms of trying to include, but they didn't always, they weren't always that visionary because, you know, if you are a product of your time, you're doing the best you can. So, but I was always for it, you know, and when I started writing science fiction, people said, well, it's a male-dominated field. And I thought, maybe I can get a date. But, you know, there are things about hitting on people that they don't like it, so I leave them alone. But I never thought that because it was a male-dominated field that I would be left out, you know, that it wasn't for me. But that's just me. Sometimes I'm really tone deaf. And I thought, well, you know, it's like I want in on this. And I I'm kind of dumb. I didn't get it. So, but I did see there were women writers, and I thought, you know, if I like science fiction, I bet there's at least 10 more just in my town who love science fiction, probably more than that. So women were always reading science fiction, but like we were the invisible audience for a long time, I guess. Anyway, times changed and things changed, and we got more women and we got more people of different, you know, ethnicities writing. And what with one thing and another, 30, 40 years passed, and I was at this workshop. It was a week-long workshop, and it was called Launchpad. And at the time, it was sponsored by NASA, and they would fly science fiction writers in and teach them real science so that we wouldn't screw up when we wrote science fiction. And it was fantastic. And they brought in some amazing people, including a writer named N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, and her first novel hadn't come out yet. And I was talking to her, and she said, you know, if I hadn't seen Octavia Stell Butler as part of science fiction, I would have thought there was no place for me in it, and I would have gone and done something else. And I thought, wow, what a close call we had, because Nora Jemisin's work is fantastic. And it's true. If everybody in here was black, and you walked in and saw an audience full of black people, and I was black too, you would think this was something for black people, and you would maybe leave, unless, of course, you were really open-minded and you felt like, you know, coming in and finding out something different. And that's the way it is for people of different colors, different origins. If they don't see themselves, and for a long time they did not see anyone like them, except, you know, maybe here and there, they felt like this was not something that they, you know, that they would be welcome in. But now they are. And then science fiction went and made me so proud of it.
The sad puppies.
The sad puppies, and I'll tell you what the sad puppies really were, okay? The sad puppies were a bunch of guys who failed to learn the lesson in kindergarten that you should be a good sport. You congratulate the winner. You don't complain that you didn't get this and you didn't get that. And if you didn't get this and you didn't get that, it's not a conspiracy. You just didn't get it, you know? And you can, and you know what? It won't kill you. But they got all bent out of shape because they felt that, you know, it's like, well, in 3 years I should get a Campbell Award, and then another 3 years I should get a Hugo, and they couldn't understand why they weren't. And it's because, you know, at the science fiction, the field keeps getting bigger. There are more writers all the time, more writers to choose from. And, you know, it's like sometimes you attract a lot of attention and sometimes you're overlooked, maybe for a while, or maybe for a long while. I was nominated for a Hugo 6 times. And on the 6th time, I got my first Hugo. Now, that nomination came 20 years after my previous nomination in 1993. And I don't think that it was because there was a conspiracy against me. I can't remember a lot of the people who won when I was nominated in my category. In fact, I can't remember any of them. That's kind of taffy. I should congratulate. But I know that I congratulated all of the winners, you know, when I was there, or I would send them an email and tell them that, you know, it's like, congratulations, I'm really happy for you. Because that's what you do. It's good manners. It's good sportsmanship. Maybe you think you should have won. Okay, go to the bathroom, lock the door, and tell the mirror that. You know, it's like, I should have won. But, you know, and the thing about writing is every day is another day. You know, anything can happen tomorrow. So, so it was really bad sportsmanship and a feeling of entitlement. And science fiction, God bless it, said, we're not going to take it. And when I didn't even know about the slates until 2015, when the notorious Hugo ballot came out, and it was dominated by sad puppy nominees. And there was this big influx of supporting memberships to the Spokane Worldcon so that people could vote for the Hugos. And some people were saying, what if it's Gamergate? What if it's the rabid puppy's friends? Because he can afford to buy them all memberships. And I said, no, I don't think so. And I was right. No award has been given a total of 12 times in the history of the Hugo. Now, in 2015, it had only been given 10 times. And 5 times was that night at the Hugos in 2015 in Spokane. And afterwards, I was at a party with the late David Harwell. And he came over to say goodnight to me because he was leaving. And I said, David, I am happier about tonight's Hugo results than I was the night I won my own Hugo. And David said, spoken like a woman who loves this field with all her heart. And that was the last thing we said to each other because David died the next year. And I am so pissed off at him because he wasn't around to see me MC the Hugos in Kansas City. But I've gotten over it. I forgive him.
So in a way, it's thanks to the set puppy that Liu Cixin won the 2015 award because he wasn't even on the ballot.
Nope. Yeah, I remember Thomas Oldehervelt asked me, he got on because they took him off. They took off someone who wasn't qualified or didn't, it was eliminated, disqualified. And he said, should I accept this nomination? I said, you certainly should. You got it fair and square. Yeah. So he said, well, okay. And he won. And he asked me to accept it for him. And that was really nice. That was a nice thing for him to do because I thought that he really should have come over and picked it up himself, you know, instead of asking me to do it. What am I, the maid around here? Just kidding. I love Thomas. And Thomas is a gent. When I won my own Hugo, I keep it. How many times will I say when I won my own Hugo during this interview? You can keep count if you want. When I won my own Hugo, Thomas was up for it in the same category, and he was there, and he was one of the first people to come over to me and say congratulations. And I said, well, thank you, as long as you don't think you got robbed. It was like, that's class. Okay, that is really class. And when I won the Clark, the second time, one of the people that I beat was Paul McCauley. And I was still living in the U.S. then, and Paul called me that night to congratulate me. That's class, you know. It's like, you show good sportsmanship and good breeding, and you can get along just about anywhere, but especially in science fiction. And get along with me, so, you know, that's a bonus.
Okay, thanks. I would like to go back a little bit to the cyberpunk, but with a future twist. Let's say, speaking with James Patrick Kelly and with Nico Gallo somewhere here, if he's here. Ah, I call him. Well, they both said to me that cyberpunk, of course, was great. We all love cyberpunk, but it was, of course, an American thing. At least you look at the world from your point of view. So now that the developing countries are producing post cyberpunk mm-hmm. stories, short stories and novels, thinking about Nigeria.
Afrofuturism.
Yes, Afrofuturism. Yes. Is it like that post cyberpunk has a better chance to represent in a way the actual zeitgeist, the spirit of the time that we are living here? Because cyberpunk also had this globalization, or you know, the effect of capitalism on the people. And of course there is an American side of it, but there is a huge side of it taking place in developing countries. So now that these people are talking about the effect, are they in a good position to represent a kind of post-cyberpunk in a fair way?
I wouldn't call it post-cyberpunk. I mean, it'll be whatever it is.
Okay.
But cyberpunk, what I was doing, you know, in my own work, and I can't speak for anyone else, was I was thinking in terms of, you know, it's like I would not be a person who developed a thing, you know, it's like I'm the end user. I always get the one that's kind of broken, that doesn't work, you know, that shorts out after 2 days. And that was what I had in mind when I was writing, you know. It's like people getting the stuff that doesn't work, or that works, you know, in unintentional ways, or you can't afford to buy the good one, so you have to buy the off-brand. And that was how I came at it. And having, you know, grown up how I did, I was always dealing with the effect of anything, mm-hmm. you know, on me, and technology was just one more thing, and technology, I thought, I'll tell you a story. I was at we used to go to this convention in Austin, Texas called ArmadilloCon. When Bruce was there, Bruce was always there. And there was this one time that this computer company asked us to come and talk to them. And Bill was there, and Tom Maddox was there, Walter John, you, and me. And we did this sort of weird panel discussion type thing. And there were the computer scientists in the audience were asking about how the internet, you know, the internet, what impact it would have on totalitarianism, you know, and that kind of thing. And Tom Maddox said, oh, the Russians will just send in the tanks like they always do, just like they did in Czechoslovakia last time. And the computer scientists were arguing with him. And I thought to myself, you know, I was listening to what they were saying very carefully. And I thought, you know, they're talking like they know something. And something like six weeks later, the Berlin Wall came down. And I thought, you know, they probably in touch with people on the other side. And they must have known something. They must have been talking to people. And of course, in America, we hardly were ever aware of anything that was happening. So we had no clue that the border of Hungary had already become porous that summer. You know, it's like, we don't know Jack in America, you know? It's like, we find out things so long after the fact, I'm surprised that we even know who's president sometimes. I mean, that would account for it, right? But there were so many things that we didn't know. And in fact, the first time I went to a non-English speaking country for Worldcon was in 1990. I went to The Hague, and I ended up on this panel about translating by complete accident, because I did not translate. I had been translated at that point, but I didn't translate. And it was the first time I'd had my consciousness raised about the problems of communicating outside the English language. And remember, there's a Spanish translator on one side, and she's talking about the difficulties she faced with, you know, it's like dealing with non-Spanish culture and trying to translate it into something that didn't sound completely off the wall. And a Dutch translator saying, well, you know, we don't have very many words for mountain in Holland. So when we get the Lord of the Rings, it's really hard not to make it sound monotonous. And it was the first time I'd ever really thought about it. And I should have, because my first sale ever had been translated into French some years before that. And they sent it to me. And I read French well enough that I can check a translation if I have a dictionary handy. And that story is so much better in French than it ever was in English. I mean, that story is wonderful in French. And I remember when Sinners came out in France, I don't know exactly how they translated it, but they needed to sell it in two volumes. So that always impressed me. I always thought, what, did they sell the two volumes together? What if one sold more than the other? What if the first volume went out of print? Yeah. But anyway, I had my consciousness raised, and even more so by the people who attended, because 1990 was, you know, it was the breakup of the Soviet Union was going on, and of course the Berlin Wall was down, and all kinds of things were happening. And people who had never been able to go to Worldcon, who wanted to, people from Poland and Austria and Russia, were coming to the Worldcon. They were absolutely beside themselves at meeting Brian Aldiss, you know, and Jack Womack, and all kinds of other writers. And there were editors and publishers there too. I remember talking to one Russian editor who's working three jobs to support her science fiction habit. And I thought, man, you know, my hat's off to you, honey, because I think someone from another more affluent background might say, too much work, I'm going to do something else. So I thought that was, you know, it was like, that was obviously a labor of love. And I thought, you know, there should really be more world in the Worldcon. And I've been really encouraged by what's happened in the last few years. We had we had London again, then we had Helsinki, we're going to have Dublin in 2019. Not in 1920. I'm dyslexic with numbers. It's called dyscalculia, but I can't pronounce that.
All right. I'll open to the questions if you want to. I think you have a wonderful chance to have two members of the original cyberpunk movement here. If no, okay, one.
You don't need any questions.
One, no. But just
you can hear me anytime.
Yeah.
Come on.
Okay. Just the exceptionality of it.
We hardly ever get together anymore.
That's true. But it was pleasant.
Viva Milano.
Ovviamente le domande potete farle in italiano e chiaro,
traduciamo,
quindi non sentitevi, non vergognatevi, non sentitevi imbarazzati, insomma, ok?
if there are no questions, then...
Certo. So, can I ask one? Because I do have a question, actually.
Okay.
I was listening to you. Lo faccio prima in italiano e poi in inglese. Quello che volevo chiedere... Quello che volevo... No, va bene. Volevo chiederle... Tu gli hai chiesto della situazione... Sorry.
Oh, wait. Here. Okay. Here's mine. It's
thank
closer.
You.
Yeah.
Okay. No, ok, si sente meglio. Tu prima hai citato la situazione politica attuale, lei ha fatto un quadro più ampio parlandoti anche del passato, di come si è posta nei confronti di certe situazioni. Volevo chiedere molto brevemente, torno un attimino sull'argomento, ma se pensa che oggi la situazione del mondo, dell'America, dell'Europa, scelga lei, è uno spunto creativo interessante per un autore di letteratura fantastica. Nel dettaglio, se non ti spero che non abbia un'altra domanda. Now I just want to touch upon what Francesco mentioned earlier, because he mentioned the situation, the political situation in UK, US, briefly, and you expanded on that. But if you don't mind getting back to that for a moment, my curiosity is very simple. I'd like to know if you think as a writer and as a informed citizen, you know, as a reader as well, if today's situation is food for thought and an interesting material for writers, if people living in interesting times, it has happened in the past, are, you know, brought to write sci-fi when you live in times like these, I would say, or not. Maybe we are too worried about something very real, so not a given, I don't know. Like your opinion.
Well, if my mother were alive now, she'd say, you can't make this shit up.
Questa l'avete capita tutti. Yeah, they got that.
Okay. You know, when I, the first time I went to Poland, the mother country, my other mother country, I was going to talk at some universities, and my mother sat me down. It was the year 2000, and... George W. Bush had just been elected for the first time. And she said, before you go into your little science fiction thing, you tell them that Americans of good conscience are sorry. And I said, should I tell them for what? She said, they'll know. So I told them, and they knew. And I thought that's probably as bad as it's... No, that's not as bad as it's gonna get, you know? When Barack Obama was elected, I thought, you know, it was like, at last. There might actually be hope for North Americans, North Americans in the United States, because Barack Obama was one of the very few presidents that I felt like, if I walked up to him on the street and he asked me how I was doing and I told him, he would understand, he'd get it. You know, after Bill Clinton, our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity ended with George W. Bush, I thought after Barack Obama, and I had no idea that things would swing that badly, that that people would be taken in by all of the, well, I don't even have words for it. I should learn Italian, maybe Italian has words for it. But I, you know, of course every time is worth writing about. Even, you know, if it seems to be a very good time, because nothing's ever perfect. But you know, when I think about what's going on with you know, Trump in America, and then Brexit, and if, you know, it's like, oh, if you had another referendum in England now, everyone would say, "Oh God, let us stay. We don't want to go." It's only a bunch of, you know, politicians that want to go now. And the thing about the referendum, should we stay or should we leave the EU, was it was not a binding referendum. It was only informational. It was taking the temperature of the nation to find out how they felt. And a lot of people voted to leave as a protest of some kind. I'm not sure what they thought they were protesting, and they didn't think they were going to win. And they were horrified when, you know, when Brexit came out on top. And I know I know a few people who were for it and then saw, you know, the result. The economy in the toilet, and to their credit, they are horrified by the hate crimes that, you know, people seem to have, certain awful people have taken this as a sign that they should go out and persecute, you know, persecute people of color. But the thing is like, they're telling second and third generation Indians and Pakistanis to go back where they came from. Okay, they'll go back where they came from. They'll go back to Brixton. They'll go back to, you know, Islington. They'll go back to my neighborhood in South Tottenham. And, boy, I don't know what the question was, but I got lost in the answer. But, you know, the funny thing is, I will keep talking. You have to forcibly stop me. It's obvious my political standing. I'm a bleeding heart liberal from a long line of bleeding heart liberals. And yet, I have a wide conservative readership. I have a lot of readers who identify as conservatives. And basically it's because the one thing that we all agree on is story. You know, it's like, and a good story is a good story. And in my stories, you could probably tell who and what I am by reading them, but they're not polemics, and they don't tell you what to think. They operate outside of, you know, they're not political screeds. But if asked, I will, you know, I'll gladly identify who and what I am, and I won't apologize for it. Boy, there wasn't any question. I got lost in the answer. I'll stop now.
But I'll go back to the... If there are no other questions from the public...
Nah, everybody knows everything now.
Just an adding. You are horrified by the Trump chair.
Yes.
But, you know, we have had Berlusconi longer before you had Trump. So, in a way, on the political side, Italy, for once... was the cyberpunk in politician tragedy.
Yeah, but you know, the problem is that people in Europe don't know how big America is. Yeah. And actually, people in America don't know how big America is. They talk about the difference between Europe and America and the United States is that in Europe, they think 100 miles is a long way, and in America, they think 100 years is a long time. Yes, it's 50 years old. We put a plaque on it, you know, and then open a shopping center beside it. But there used to be this thing in America. You know, the big thing was, hey, anyone could grow up to be president. Well, now anyone has. And I don't think that they're going to make it that easy anymore. When they said anyone could grow up to be president, what they had in mind actually was that if you go to school and learn something and don't be a dumbass, then you might grow up to be president. But it seems that now we, you know, I couldn't go into a business and be the CEO just because I wanted to be. I would have to have a resume. And Trump doesn't even have a resume as an alderman, you know. He wasn't even a ward boss. And there was plenty of opportunity for that in New York. So I'm appalled that we have someone who has absolutely no experience and has absolutely no sense of statesmanship and wants to pick a fight with the only other nation crazier than he is. And and doesn't get it as well. He's more clueless than I was at my most clueless. You know, I can't even apologize for this. There's no apology that I can make. Ugly American.
All right. I'll go back to you something lighter. Yes, let's.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah. You mentioned a good story is a good story. So once you said that I have, quote, I have one criterion for a good book in whatever style or genre, and that's while you're reading, if the words go away and you're watching the movie in your head, that's a good book. If you've got that, you've got characterization, you've got scene, you've got definitely good plotting. So is this the way, and this is the suggestion that you might give to readers, or, you know, is this the way it works for you?
Yeah, it still does. It still works that way for me. And I learned just how important that was when I was having chemotherapy. I'll bring up my cancer, too. When I was having chemotherapy, I would read. And sometimes it was hard to read because I'd fall asleep at the end of every sentence. But then I would wake up and read the next sentence. But when I was reading, the good books took me completely out of the chemo suite and into the story. And I realized, I'm right about that. You know, it's like if a book engrosses you, you know, if the story engrosses you, and you don't even necessarily have to agree with it. Lou Scheiner wrote this book, and I'm losing the title. Maybe you about the rock stars going back to revive them, the ones that died, change history.
Mozart and Mary Shades.
No.
Story.
And this was a novel.
Oh, right, yeah, it's rock novel.
The rock novel.
Yeah,
the rock novel.
Sorry.
Yeah, very helpful, I'm sorry. But I went all the way through that book reading it, you know, I read every single word and I argued with it. I argued with the whole premise, I argued with, you know, with the plot, and I argued with the characters, and I got to the end, and we still didn't see eye to eye, but it was a decent experience, you know, it was a good book. And there aren't many books that can engage me that way. You know, it's like you have to be a really good writer to keep me reading because, you know, it's like once if something clangs on you and you realize, no, this would never happen. You know, this couldn't possibly be, or these characters are behaving like idiots. You know, that's the idiot plot. It only works if everyone in the story is an idiot. Like, you know, horror movies from Hollywood. go into the house in your negligee. That's what I call a great book.
Okay. Would you give us three good titles of books like that?
Okay.
Not necessarily from science fiction.
Okay, let me think. Because this varies from, you know, day to day, and sometimes even from hour to hour. What was that book you wrote about?
I don't remember all my own titles.
Yeah, I don't remember all mine either.
Holy Fire.
No, not that one. The one about the woman.
The one with the plot.
At one point, she ends up in a prison camp, and she
Islands in the Net.
Islands in the Net, man. I didn't want that book to end.
Well, you're living it now, sister.
Yeah. That was Islands in the Net by Bruce, and probably anything else he's written. But that particular one grabbed me, you know, and it dragged me through, and I just, when I got down in the pages became, you know, less and less, and I was thinking, oh, it's going to end, Oh, damn it, it ended. But boy, you know, it's so like, it was great while it lasted.
Was that Glimpses, the Lewis
Shiner? Yes, Glimpses. Yeah. Glimpses. That's Glimpses by Lewis Shiner.
Not the world's most memorable title.
No, no. No. But, yeah, but the book I argued with all the way through. And Glimpses by Lewis Shiner, Islands in the Net by Bruce. I'm going to name two others because we've already covered Glimpses. Let me see. Oh, there's this, wait, let me get my equipment out. Thank you, got it. Oh no, don't put it over there, my drugs are in it. I will have to be surgically removed from my iPad. Because, as I understand it, they won't cremate you holding an iPad. There was this history book that I read by John Higgs. It was not that long ago. So it should still be sort of in the upper area. Wait, I can search for it. Just bear with me. This will only take like, you know, an hour or two. Oh, don't give me that.
That's what
I was looking for. I know. Okay. Well, it's by John Higgs. It says that it won't search if I'm not online.
Oh.
So, you know, it's fussy. Hey, I spend most of my life not online. It's good enough for me, it's good enough for you. There was this book it's a history of the 20th century, and it's by a man named John Higgs. And it's one of the best histories that I've ever read because it ties everything together. It covers everything that happens in each era. And it starts out with... let's see. Stranger than we can imagine. I'm shocked, you know. My memory. Stranger than we can imagine by John Higgs. I didn't want that book to end, and now I want John Higgs to write all the histories of everything because he did that so well. Okay. Let me see if I can find my third candidate here. Let's see. Bear with me.
I read a lot of e-books back.
Yeah, because I can find them. Particularly for research. I still do read, you know, paper books. And my kid is a real snob. I offered to get him e-books. He said, I want a real book. Ooh, ooh. But, he comes by it honestly. We told him when he was little that he could have any book that he wanted. Couldn't have any toy. But, you know, it's like if it was a book, he could have it. And you know, it was like I made his father bite his tongue and let him read Marilyn Manson's autobiography because, hey, it was a book and he was reading it. There's this book by Kim Newman and Eugene Byrne that's actually a series of stories, and it's alternative history called Back in the USSA. And it's the USSA was, you know, Soviet, and you know the rest of the world was not, and it's hilarious because the American things aren't that absurd, you know, and I found that, you know, wonderful. Oh, and there's this other book by Tricia Sullivan called Occupy Me.
She was here last year. She was guest of honor last year here.
Oh, okay. Well, hey. Yeah, we were talking about like going on a book tour together and calling it the Pat Tricia Roadshow, because she has the other half of my name and I have the first half of hers. And I'm sorry. Three. Don't limit me to three.
Yeah, but you're running out of time.
I don't care. Let them drag me up here. Okay, I'll stop.
Okay, if there's no very fast question, I'll thank Pat Cadigan for being here. Thank you for listening.
Thank you all for holding still for this.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache dalla galassia. Una produzione Recast Media Factory. Da un'idea originale di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafini, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof. Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito recast.media, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @FantasciCast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/Fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/FSC Community. Se siete particolarmente timidi potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica, scrivendoci all'indirizzo fantascientificast@recast.media. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes e su Spreaker all'indirizzo podcast.recast.media. Se volete potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal o Patreon utilizzando gli appositi pulsanti sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale, non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. Autorizzazione SIAE 56125359. Nessun byte e nessun trivolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. L'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augura lunga vita e prosperità e vi dà appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Io ne ho viste cose che voi umani non potreste immaginarvi. Navi da combattimento in fiamme al largo dei bastioni di Orione. E ho visto i raggi B balenare nel buio vicino alle porte di Tannhäuser. E tutti quei momenti andranno perduti nel tempo, come lacrime nella pioggia. È tempo di morire.
How to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free.
Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.